About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Phil Rowley, and he'll be answering your most important questions on fly fishing still waters with piranomids. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Phil a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so that you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just go ahead and fill in your name and email address in the form and submit it, and we'll keep you informed as we go along. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Phil Rowley about fly fishing still waters with piranomids. Captain Bob Jaspers of Flats Time Charters will introduce you to the Mosquito Lagoon, Indian River, and No Motor Zone of the Banana River on the east coast of Central Florida. Only a short drive from Orlando, you will sight fish for big redfish, spotted sea trout, and black drum, as well as a seasonal snook and tarpon. Captain Bob is a lifetime resident of the area and has chosen his knowledge of the local fish, flora, and fauna. Call Flats Time Charters today and arrange your next memorable adventure. You can reach Captain Bob Jaspers at 321-631-4051. That's 321-631-4051, or go to his website at www.flatstime.com. That's FLATSTIME.com. Well, before we introduce Phil, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. We're giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have 2 chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, just go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com. Look for the link under Phil's section that says click here to register for the drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners of that drawing at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away Phil's latest book, Still Water Solutions Recipes, Volume 1, as well as a DVD on tying stillwater flies. And here's how you can win that. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question's going to be about something we talked about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and your location in that same text box on the homepage that you use to submit questions on. So what we're going to do tonight, since Phil has been so gracious to provide 2 gifts, is the first and second place winners of that the first place winner will get the book, the second place winner will get the DVD. So we have 2 chances for you to win on that tonight. So pay attention during the show, and first one to answer the question gets the prize. Well, tonight our guest is Phil Rowley, and at the age of 6, Phil was introduced to coarse fishing in England and has been hooked ever since. For over 20 years, Phil has been fly fishing still waters almost exclusively. His love of stillwater fly fishing has taken him all over British Columbia and Washington in the pursuit of trout and char. A former commercial fly tyer, Phil has written for almost every major fly fishing publication in North America. Phil's book, Fly Patterns for Still Waters, has become a bestseller. As a complement to Fly Patterns for Still Waters, Phil released Stillwater Solutions Recipes, Volume 1. That's what we're going to be giving away tonight. And that was co-authored with his longtime friend, Brian Chan. Phil has a number of DVDs, including DVD Tying Flies for Still Waters and 2 recently released DVDs with Jack Dennis, Snake River Books. When he is not tying flies or on the water, Phil travels Western North America performing at outdoor shows, teaching a variety of seminars, speaking to fly clubs, and conducting weekend fly fishing schools. In addition to Phil's shows and seminars, he has the good fortune to appear on such TV shows as Sports Fishing BC, Fishing Alberta, The New Fly Fisher, and Fishing with Shelley and Courtney. Recently, Phil became one of the co-hosts of The New Fly Fisher, a television production dedicated to fly fishing education. Phil's website, www.flycraftangling.com, is dedicated to fly fishing and fly tying education, featuring tips, techniques, and stream video. This comprehensive site is constantly changing to meet the needs of its members. In early 2004, Phil, along with good friend Brian Chan, released a signature line of Flytying Materials, Chris, and Stillwater Solutions in partnership with Superfly. Well, Phil, that's quite a lot to talk about. Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Well, thank you for having me, Roger. I'm looking forward to this.
Phil and I kind of went over the questions earlier today, and we were both very impressed with the questions tonight. You guys did another outstanding job asking questions, and Phil says he thinks he's got all the answers. At least he's going to give it a shot. So I think you folks will be very well enlightened tonight by the end of the show. What we're going to do is we're going to talk a little bit about Stillwater itself and some of the equipment and setups. We're going to talk about the food and the flies, focusing primarily on chironomids because that's a specialty that Phil has developed, and also some other Stillwater patterns that he finds real useful out there. And then, of course, we're going to spend probably the majority of the time talking about presentation of these flies because that's the key. So, well, Phil, let's get started.
Okay.
Right off the bat, let's talk about what Stillwater is. Can you kind of give us a definition, and does it apply to only lakes and so forth, or does it also apply to rivers and streams?
Well, it applies to rivers and streams as well, and actually you could argue that Stillwaters is a bit of a misnomer. I'd almost say standing water, the stuff you leave in your backyard in the wheelbarrow that mosquitoes love to breed in, that's Stillwater. Even in lakes, there is current there, some degree of current and circulation all the time, whether it's induced by temperature or more commonly by wind. So it's a bit of a misnomer, but definitely the water is flowing a lot slower than a river or stream.
So as far as the insects we're going to be talking about tonight, they could live in any of those sections.
Yeah, they can. You'll find, you know, insects, they don't get any entomology lessons when they grow up or know what habitat they are and aren't supposed to be in. But you'll find, you know, when I've developed a lot of my patterns and thoughts, I did a lot of studying of spring creeks, for example, slow-moving water, similar presentation considerations, pattern designs, selectivity of fish, those kind of things. So, you know, studying the works of Mike Lawson and authors like that really helped develop my Stillwater skills as well. You got to learn to sort of look outside the bubble.
Mike Lawson was our first show on Spring Creeks. So
yeah, he's a great great innovator and one heck of a fisherman, fly fisherman.
Yeah, great teacher too.
Yeah.
Now, is there you started and grew up fishing in England,
mm-hmm.
and of course Canada, and you fished in the U.S. and so you fish in all different parts of the world. Is there a difference in Stillwaters in different parts of the world that make a difference or your approach?
Yeah, you'll find there, and it's mostly related to geography. If you look at Western North America, you've got that spine that runs down south central British Columbia, Alberta, through the prairies, and down through the western states, Washington, Oregon, Idaho, Wyoming, etc. Those states, you know, based on a geographic makeup, are home to some very productive stillwater fisheries. Very shallow, lots of sunlight. You're going to get lots of sunlight penetration. Stimulates weed growth through photosynthesis. With weed growth, that's where all the food sources live. You've also got what they call lakes will go through and cycle their water over time, flushing, and they don't flush very much. Don't quote me on these numbers, but let's say those lakes will take 100 years to totally flush out. Any of the nutrients that get brought into that lake are going to stay there, calcium, phosphorus, magnesium, other minerals like that. They really, you know, it's a good fertile base for a lake. You get to a coastal lake, such as what, when I lived in the Vancouver area, steep-sided, not much in the way of shallow shoal areas, lots of flushing due to annual rainfall, those kind of things. Not as productive an environment. There's not as many nutrients in the water. The weed growth isn't the same. And conversely, you just don't get the, you know, the big quality fish that most people recognize Stillwaters for. So there are differences, and, you know, you learn to study those. Lots of great books out there. My colleague Brian Chan's got some great books. If you want to get into it, a lot of university texts, and, of course, the Internet nowadays is just a wealth of information.
Right, right. And we're primarily talking tonight about the colder still waters that, mm-hmm. that trout live in rather than warm water lakes. Or will some of the methods we talk about apply to warm water as well?
Yeah, they will definitely work. Of course, you've got different fish species. I have caught a few smallmouth bass on chironomids, but I wasn't definitely targeting them. But a lot of the logic that I use on lakes works on other species. Now that I live in Alberta, in addition to the great trout fishing we have here, we've also got pike and walleye fishing, and those fish take the fly as readily as a trout, in some cases arguably more readily if you think about how aggressive a pike can be. And they are fish at heart, and they follow and do the same things, and that's how I was able to figure out the local walleye fishing here on the fly. Nobody was really doing it, and I find them very, very trout-like, very sensitive feeders, and my years of chronomon fishing paid off to help detect the often subtle takes that those fish feed with. So lots of transferable lessons here, so you don't need to get stereotyped.
Good, good. Yeah, a lot of people are talking about walleye more and more in the fly fishing world, and, you know, it used to be something that, oh, you trolled for them down deep with bait and that, you know, or lures, and that was it. That's the only way you caught them. And now all kinds of people are getting them on the fly. So,
well, one of my favorite methods, and we'll talk about this when we get in presentation, is the dry line, relatively long leader approach that's sort of synonymous with chironomid fishing, and I just, you know, step it up a notch and fish a lot of woolly bugger patterns, clouser minnows, and the same kind of presentation techniques. And the walleyes, although they're armored with that full set of teeth, they typically feed by flaring their gills and inhaling their prey, and it's almost like they clamp onto the fly and will give you a two count to dare to find them, and if not, they'll spit your fly out and move on. So they're very challenging, and they're a lot of fun. And once you find a school of them, they may not fight like a trout, but by the end of a day's fishing, your forearm's pretty sore.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about equipment. One thing that we didn't have on our list, but I definitely want to cover, is what do you prefer for rod size and weight?
Generally for my lake fishing, anywhere from a 5 to a 7 weight. It depends on the species I'm chasing. We talked about pike and walleye, for example. You know, pike can even go into the 8-9 range, depending on what size of pike you intend to encounter. I've got some lakes around here that have got them close to 30 pounds, so they can give you a bit of a workout. But primarily for my trout, I would say 5 and 6 weights. Wind usually governs it. You know, typically when I go out on the water, I've got at least 2 rods strung and lots of spare reels or spools to match the conditions and what Mother Nature wants to throw at me on that particular day. But especially when you're sitting in a boat, and I learned this lesson or was driven home in the Canadian Fly Fishing Championships last September, sitting in a boat with a 5 weight and casting from a seated position all the time, rules forbid even standing up to stretch or whatever in the boats we were in. So that 6 weight or even a 7 weight, the backbone just helps make a long day's casting a little bit more pleasurable. As far as actions, probably a medium flex. I don't like really, fast action rods sure cast the fly nice, but they're also, when we're using long leaders, they help open up the loop a little bit to make casting long leaders a little easier, a little bit more sensitive, and with the sort of the soft takes that you get, they're a little bit more forgiving. If you're a little heavy-fisted or a stiff rod, you can be breaking some good fish off.
Now, what about reels? Anything in particular there that...
As far as brand or just single
action? Just functionality, you know.
Just for the most... Your click and pull type reels work fine, or even the newer drag systems. Again, it depends on the lakes. A lot of times you're able just to play the fish, you know, just by stripping it in, but obviously lakes are known for big fish that get rambunctious at times when they get hooked. And so you'd like a reel with a good smooth drag system and the ability to pick up line. Some of the large arbor reels are nice. I use Islanders myself, and they work very well, very simple, very clean lines, and work very, very well.
Okay, we have a couple of questions, related questions about line. We have Frank, who I think listens every show. At least he asks questions on every show.
He's up
in BC. And he said, could you talk about fishing with floating lines versus sinking lines and when to use strike indicators and when not to?
So in particular to chironomids, I probably use floating lines, I'm going to pick a number, 75% of the time. Floating lines are just a pleasure to fish with. They're a line that if you're migrating over from river or stream fishing, you've got in your kit bag already. And they're so versatile. You can cover water 20 feet deep just by varying the leader length and some other variables, which I'm sure we'll get into a little later. And then the sinking lines, we do chironomid fishing as well with sinking lines, especially obviously when they're in deeper water, say in excess of 20 feet. We use intermediates, some of the clear tip lines that are out nowadays, the fast sinking lines. We actually fish them vertically in deep water and literally cast the length of leader and line out that you're anchored in. So 25 feet deep, 25 feet of line and leader from the tip of the rod to your fly, and cast that out, let it sink, and bring it up vertically. And it's a very exciting method because the fish really pound the fly with that vertical presentation.
And that's with chronomids.
Yep. And strike indicators, generally I use those, I'll say, in water 12 feet deep or less. It gets into when you're fishing as slow as you have to do sometimes to be successful. If you don't have that strike indicator suspending the fly, it's going to end up in the weeds or getting fouled up, and you're not going to get the presentation you like. The other thing that strike indicators do as well is give you that precise depth control. And in many instances, that in any stillwater environment, finding the depth the fish are feeding at, you'll catch fish. You know, I often say they're selective on depth, but opportunistic on what they feed upon. You may think they get up in the morning and have a craving for chironomids, but there's just so many of those around, they just end up feeding on those a lot.
Okay. One question that came in on the internet, Joe Paul Myers in Oklahoma wants to know, as far as floating line, is there a particular color that you prefer?
I just go with a lot of the, you know, I typically got either chartreuse or the, you know, the hot orange that most manufacturers come in. Right now I'm using a chartreuse Rio Grande, and it works fine. You know, they're all high-vis colors, and they all stand out very well. I haven't used any of the sort of camel floating lines or the clear floating lines because, especially in chironomid fishing, and a lot of the techniques we're going to talk about with that, you can just replace the chironomid with a scud or a damsel and make a few alterations, and you'll still fish the same way. You want to be able to see that fly line. It acts as a big strike indicator. And once you learn to watch the fly line and learn to, you know, the English are very good at saying if you feel a take, you should be on a floating line, you should be able to have seen it first. So you'll get an eye for it, and places to look. Typically we look where the fly line touches the water right at the rod tip, or if conditions are good and you depending how you're sitting in your boat or your pontoon boat, you can see the tip of the fly line and you just watch it for signs of movement. And you just gotta sort of take that leap of faith, and when you see a movement that just looks out of sync with what the retrieve you're doing, that's a fish probably grabbed your fly and starting to move away with it, and you need to set the hook or he'll spit the fly out and be gone.
Okay. What about the intermediate sinking line?
They're probably the most underrated line in stillwaters. They are a great line. Their slow sink rate allows you to present not only chironomids, but other food sources, scuds, damselflies, leeches, at a nice, slow, natural pace. These insects aren't Olympic athletes. They're not setting world records down there. They're just going about their sort of daily business, doing their foraging or rooting around. So they move very slowly. So you may be anchored in say, 15 feet of water and be thinking, maybe I should use a type 2 or a type 3 line. But that fly line sinks so fast, it's not really a race to the bottom. It's about getting your fly down to that depth that the fish are feeding at and then keeping it there for as long as you can. So you want to choose a fly line that doesn't overpower the presentation, and the intermediate is great for that.
Okay. Greg in California wants to know about particular knots you use, and then also John French in Southern California as well wants to know, you have a system to determine the length of your leader and the diameter of the leader, so maybe you could talk about those two, you know, talk about terminal tackle here.
Yeah, I'm a, as my father said, a KISS principle, to keep it simple, stupid, so it's not a complex system. For my pure chironomid fishing, I like to use a nail knot directly onto the fly line. I'll put about 2 feet of butt section, say 25 to 30 thou diameter, 25 thou for your 5 weights, 30 thou diameter for your 7 weights, that kind of thing. From there, I'll take a standard tapered leader, mono leader, and using a blood knot, connect that to the butt section, and that'll range anywhere from 9 to 12, 15 feet, and then from there, add tippet. And I use a triple surgeon's knot at that connection, and my tippet sections are always fluorocarbon when I'm using sinking presentations. And from there, whenever I tie a fly on, whether it's nowadays a dry fly, a pike fly, and especially chironomids, I use a non-slip loop knot. This is an open knot, like a Duncan loop, but when the fish strikes, it does not draw tight to the fly. It stays, it's almost like a clinch knot with a stopper. It's called the non-slip loop knot. I've seen it called the 97% knot, or the Rapala knot for any of the listeners who have, you know, used Rapalas before. And it really provides additional added action, and it's a very strong knot. It holds very well. So it's a simple system. As for leader length, with my floating lines, when I'm coronamid fishing without an indicator, I like to use a leader that's about 25% longer than the depth of water I'm fishing. And the reason is because the line leader, because of the taper in the monofilament and the leader, that helps turn over those long lengths. You know, I'm talking leaders, I fish them up to 25 feet long at times. Typically, I'm fishing 15 to 18 feet. That butt section and the taper, the butt section on the tapered leader, that all helps flip that over. But it doesn't sink straight off the end of the fly line. It sinks in an arc. So you need that added 25% just to compensate for that. So, for example, if I'm fishing 15 feet, my leader is going to be about 19 feet long. For my sinking lines, anywhere from, generally the faster the sink rate, the shorter the leader. So with an intermediate, I'll be 9 to 12 feet and start going down there to a type 6 line, for example, specialized technique that uses floating flies like foam-based or deer hair-based. You might use 3 or 4 feet a leader. And the concept with that is the line lies along the bottom and the floating fly skips above the weed tops. And generally, the clearer the water, you got to go a little longer leader and maybe sometimes downsize the tippet size a little bit, although I try to get away as heavy as I can. And most times I'm fishing 8.2 breaking strain, Floraflex Plus, and, you know, you're able to land the fish and, you know, with a minimum of risk for playing it out and get it back into the wilds again.
Now, going back to your terminal knot there, the loop, you're doing that so that you get more action on the fly, I take it?
Exactly. It's unlike a clinch knot or other knot that jams up tight against the hook eye, this is open. It's almost like a monofilament swivel, if you want. So this fly is free to dance. Again, it just adds a little bit of natural motion. I've got an inanimate object that I'm trying to inject as much life as I can in to convince a fish that it's the real deal. So any kind of little motion I can put in there, and like I said earlier, I use that on coronamids, streamer patterns, leeches, baitfish, damselflies, scuds, dry flies, everything. It's a good knot. There's lots of instructions for it on the internet.
Great, great. Well, we need to take a break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Phil more about fly fishing with coronamids in still waters. At Housatonic River Outfitters, we offer the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with our guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, we offer guided fly fishing trips and spit fishing guide trips for warm water species as well. Please tour our website at www.dryflies.com to view the fishing products and guide services we offer in Connecticut and Massachusetts. We were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services, and we have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about Housatonic Outfitters, visit www.dryflies.com, www.dryflies.com. Well, you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Phil Rowley about fly fishing still waters with coronamids. If you'd like to ask Phil a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Phil, before we go any further here, I wanted to give you a chance to let people know about what you're doing in the fly fishing world as far as your business and so forth, because you're doing quite a bit from what I can tell and keeping quite busy. So tell us what you're up to.
Well, yeah, it's been a busy year. February of this year, for the past 4 years prior to February, I was working for Superfly International, Canadian-based fly tying materials distributor. That employment relationship had started with Brian Chan and I, you know, creating the Stillwater Solutions material line. And I was offered an opportunity to come on full-time in addition to my co-host duties, but become the director of marketing and communications for the new Fly Fisher television show. So I get to make fly fishing television with myself and a couple of other hosts, including Brian Chan. He's one of the hosts that comes on from time to time. Jeff Pierce, Bill Spicer, and producer Colin McEwen, we all get on there, and we get to travel all over the place. I've been this year alone fly fishing still waters in Alaska, Labrador. I was in Castlegar. We've got a busy season coming up this September. We're trying to shoot 26 shows. So that broadcasts, I think we reach about 90 million households right now. So we're all over Canada and the United States on a variety of networks. In addition, obviously, you talked about the books and DVDs I do, the speaking. You mentioned Fly Fusion. I'm actually their entomology columnist. And I also do a fly tying column for Breezy Outdoors magazine, in addition to other magazines I write for all over North America. So I'm kept pretty busy.
Sounds like it. Sounds like it.
And I'm not complaining.
Hopefully you. Oh, what is your website address again?
So my personal website address is www.flycraftangling.com. So people can go there. There's a lot of my tips on chironomid fishing there. Step by step pattern recipes are there with tying instructions. They can contact me there as well. It's designed to be an information portal on stillwater fishing, but other types of fly fishing as well. To give people a chance to, you know, we all had an opportunity to learn from somebody, so I'm just trying to pass what I've learned along to others as well.
Great,
and then the
great.
New Fly Fisher itself has its own website, thenewflyfisher.com, so there's information there too.
And then I'm sure you'll mention some of the products that you and Brian have developed for stillwater flies.
Yeah, I think we'll probably get into that with the flies, I would think.
Where would they find out information about those materials?
They can go to Superfly's website. That's www.superfly.ca. They are the Canadian distributor for the product in the United States. Spirit River distributes the products all over, and I know Cabela's carries a cross-section of the materials down there as well, but a lot of the stores in the States can get it through there as well if they're not carrying it already.
Great, great. Terrific. Well, thanks for sharing that.
No problem.
Well, we have a question here from Treg in Moscow, Idaho. He says, I fish with a strike indicator and a long leader, 20 feet plus at times. Sounds like what you were recommending there. And I still don't know how to make a strike indicator that will release so that you can bring the fish in without actually reaching for your strike indicator to allow it to slide. How do you solve this problem?
Great question. And it's been a problem for years. And I distribute personally a line of indicators in Canada and through the United States a little bit as well that's called the Quick Release Indicator. And what this is this is an indicator, and if you go to my website, there's a members section there. Membership is free. It just gives you some enhanced access to the site. And there's a site there called Quick Release Indicators. If you go there, there's video instruction on how to use these indicators. But what they essentially do is pinch a loop of leader between the indicator peg and the indicator itself. So you set this up with about an inch loop, and you set that depth. And the way it works is it's held there under tension. When the indicator's pulled under and the fish is going one way and you're raising the rod the other way, this disengages the loop and the indicator is free to slide. So for years we were doing all kinds of unique fly fishing gymnastics, trying to pull indicator pegs out and trying to land fish with the indicator stuck. It was a constant problem, but these quick release indicators have changed that. So now that indicator pulls under, you set the rod with lifting the rod, and the fish, you know, resists the pressure, and that disengages the indicator, and it's free to slide. They work like a charm.
And then I take it, let's say you have a fish on, you lose it, you know, so you just have to reset that quickly?
Yeah, exactly. The unfortunately, the peg doesn't float, but there's a few tricks you can do to avoid that. If a fish breaks you off and the peg slides free, it'll slide right off the end of the leader and you lose it. But there's little tricks if you use a little bit of split shot. Sometimes I use a barrel swivel to help in the presentation as well. What the barrel swivel does, it acts like a split shot. If there's any sort of concern about tying monofilament to fluorocarbon, the two never touch. And it also takes any sort of leader twist that comes in and keeps that leader nice and fresh and moving properly in the water. So that can act like a little bit of a stopper. And if it's legal where you're fishing to fish droppers, obviously those droppers can help stop that as well.
Now, you just said something that I hadn't heard before. You said monofilament fluorocarbon. I take it there's a problem with the knot strength.
Sometimes if monofilament's a stiffer, harder material, and sometimes if you're not careful and when you draw your knots tight and generate a little heat, it can bite into the mono and cause some premature breakage. I don't know if there's any other kind of breakage, but I don't know if there's a good time.
Unwanted breakage.
I've never had wanted, maybe with something huge I wanted it to break off, but I can't recall having that concern. But sometimes if you're not careful, you can have some incompatibility. That's why when I'm tying mono to fluorocarbon, I use triples for my tippets, I use triple surgeons. And I haven't had any breakage problems. Sometimes with the double surgeons, you can have it sometimes, but with the triple, not a problem whatsoever. and just moisten it and draw the knot slowly together. Not a sharp pull, but a gentle pulling of the knot to draw it tight.
Okay. We have a question here from Rafe in Nottingham, UK.
My hometown, my home country.
Yeah. He asks, when you fish acronomid to deep-lying fish more than a rod length down, do you still fish a bite indicator? And critically, if so, then how do you set up the rigs so the indicator doesn't stop you from my... Well, you just answered that part of the question.
I did part of it, but yes, I do use them. You know, I remember an earlier question was, do I have any sort of guidelines? I generally fish indicators in water less than, let's say, 10 to 12 feet deep. Again, when you're fishing them slow enough, you don't want your presentation to the fly to overpower and sink into the weeds and get fouled up. Sometimes when we're fishing into weed pockets, we'll use indicators as well. They're like a teacup. They're ringed with weeds all around them and weeds along the bottom, so you want to suspend them, especially when trout are in very shallow waters such as early spring, late fall. But when you get deeper than 12 feet, I will use them from time to time because there are times trout, their moods change, and they don't want food moving at all. They will not touch a fly if it's moving at all, and it's... You know, if the weather conditions, the barometer is dropping and things like this, that'll put them off, or they're just water temperatures are cool, their metabolism is slow, they're not going to chase flies very much. This often happens early spring, and we fish those static. It's a bit like just fishing with a bobber and a worm when you were a kid.
Yeah.
But it still works, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes, though, when you're fishing deeper waters, let's say 16, 18 feet under an indicator, I've had some instances where the indicator pulls under and comes back up again, and the fish has grabbed it, and I just can't react to it quick enough. And I believe sometimes that the fish is grabbing your fly and sampling it. It's, the fish's mouth is like our hands. It looks like food. It samples it. It starts to swim away. It either senses that it's a fraud or feels the tension starting to build on the resistance and spits the fly out. And just as it's spitting, that indicator is starting to pull under it, you're missing the fish. So in those instances, I'll actually take the leader off and go with the dry line long leader method. We actually christen it the naked technique because it doesn't have an indicator on it. And we fish by touch. And that's that 25% leader formula. You cast it out, you let it sink, you bring it back with that ridiculously slow retrieves everybody's probably heard of with acronomid fishing, and just go by your sense of feel or pay close attention to that fly line, because it in turn becomes a 90-foot strike indicator its whole length.
Well, one final question here about equipment, and then we'll get into some fly questions. Do you have to be a great caster on lakes? You have to cast long, and we've got a lot of new people on, so they're probably
not necessarily. Not obviously, the longer distance you can cast, the more water you can cover. And in some presentations, like with leeches or streamers or things that you may fish with a more active retrieve, you can induce a fish to follow. And then as that fly starts to raise out of the water, we actually fish a technique called the hang, where we stop the fly. And that's where a fish has been, you know, drawn by curiosity of the fly. It's following it. The fly stops. Now it's hanging there helplessly. Quite often they'll just turn and take it. And I've actually had fish follow that fly right up to the surface and sip a leech pattern just dangling just beneath the surface. Take it like a dry fly, just a gentle sip and turn away, and you see the whole thing before your eyes. Also, sometimes that rising action kind of induces a take. It's, I guess, the Stillwater equivalent of Sawyer's induced take. So the longer you cast, that helps. But conversely, there are instances, especially when you're fishing strike indicators with acronomids, you want to keep that cast nice and close. And I use a guide no more than the weight forward section on your fly line. So that's about 30 feet with most manufacturers. And I've got friends that are just lethal with strike indicators, and they're fishing 10 to 15 feet of fly line out their rod tip, and they're just glued to that indicator, because not all indicator techniques are the classic bubble trail. We all like to see it gets jammed down so hard that it leaves a trail of bubbles behind it. Sometimes it just veers to the left or the right, or just starts to pull under, just kind of goes decks awash, if you will. So you're paying, just like nymph fishing on a river, you're tuned in to any sort of movement that doesn't look like it's natural to the presentation. So in short, you don't have to cast a mile.
yeah, great. Yeah, a lot of guides will tell their fly fishers, you know, their clients and so forth, that they're missing more than they're ever seeing in the indicator. I mean, we don't see the subtleties of the take with the
indicator. No, and that's one of the reasons the Czech nymphing technique has taken off so long. They've done the underwater studies on rivers and seen flies suspended between it under an indicator get sampled and spat out, and the angler never knew they had a grab.
Yeah. Okay, question. Let's move into flies
and
the food that they represent, because I'm sure that's a big part of it here. J.B. Herrick in Harrisburg, Virginia, just puts it out there. I love his question here. He says, okay, I'm going to ask the obvious question. What the heck is a chironomid, and what fish do you catch with it? I'm pretty new to fly fishing. This is only my second year, so I'm still pretty clueless about many things. I'm learning to really like lake fishing, though, and even though there aren't many in my area. Is this a fly that can be used in lakes in Western Virginia and surrounding areas? So, what the heck is a chironomid?
A chironomid is, in some circles, it's known as a midge, you know, the San Juan system in New Mexico. Those are midges. Those are chironomids because river and stream species tend to be a lot smaller. Many of the rivers don't freeze over, so they have very short cycles, so they don't get as big. You know, up here in Western North America, Western Canada, we get chironomids that are close to an inch long, some of the pupa. They're big. They're huge. But chironomids are worldwide. On any system, river or lake, they typically outnumber all the other insects combined, so they're very prolific. There's probably over, I think, 2,500 species in Western North America alone, and they're constantly, you know, reclassifying and finding new ones all the time. So they're very, very widespread. And a chironomid looks, the adults look like a mosquito. They're from the Dipteran order, two-winged, so they look just like a mosquito. Thankfully, they don't have the long drill bit to bite you. They have a complete life cycle, so for all intents and purposes, they start with an egg. The egg hatches into the larva, which is often called a bloodworm, because many species are able to retain hemoglobin, which enables them to live in oxygen-poor conditions, such as along the bottom where many of them live. They construct tubes along the mud-water interface, lots of decay down there, so not a lot of oxygen. The pupa is worm-like, horrible swimmer, wiggles around with a vigorous head-to-tail lashing motion. Depending on the species, weeks to months to sometimes a year, they seal themselves off and become the pupa. And that is the term. When people say, I'm fishing chironomids, that's generally what they're talking about most times in most circles I fish with. When I got them on chironomids, although chironomids are the whole species, they're probably more referring in their own lingo to the pupal stage, which looked like a comma. They got a bulbous thorax, very slender abdomen. You know, they're very skinny overall. They've got prominent white gills on their heads, and some species have smaller caudal gills at the tip of their abdomen, the tail. And they use trapped air and gases and slowly elevate their way up to the surface, painstakingly slow. A few wiggles in between. I have seen some species when they get up near the surface zone, so they can sense their freedom and they start wriggling a little more vigorously. Then the adults hatch out into the, you know, the two-winged adult that looks a lot like a mosquito, and they buzz around, mate, lay eggs, usually within 24 hours the cycle's complete, and off they go again. And there's just so many of them. There's such a prolific insect. That's why they're so important on lakes to become familiar with, especially the productive lakes, because they're just the number one food source.
So you're primarily fishing the pupa stage, then?
Yeah, the pupal stage, if you were to break it in percentages, my personal experience, I'd say a good 70% is the pupal stage, maybe 75, and then 15 to 20%, and don't add all this up, it's probably going to be out a little few percentage points, the larva or bloodworm stage, and then the adults. So your pupal patterns are the most preyed upon because they're the most exposed. When they start elevating from the bottom up to the surface, they're very exposed, easy pickings for trout. The bloodworm have certain times of the year they become active, or certain times of the day, and then under certain conditions, trout will come up to the surface and feed. But most of your lakes, they can stay down even in 5-6 feet of water. All the food they ever need is right in front of their nose. They don't have to go up near the surface and expose themselves to predators.
Well, when you say bloodworm, we're talking about, isn't that when they're at the deepest level?
No, that's the larval stage of the chironomid.
Okay, I guess I'm confused.
They come in other colors, but most people have christened them bloodworm, again, because of that hemoglobin, which gives them a blood-red coloration. Now, not all species are this, have this red coloration, and in fact, some species, what they do is, iron-based blood system like ours, when they generate the hemoglobin, it turns them a red coloration. So they can actually, you know, Mother Nature loves to do this to fly fishermen, I think. Not only are all insects different colors, but some insects, and especially chironomids, have the ability to change their colors throughout the season. So if I look at a chironomid larva in early spring when the water temperatures are, you know, under you know, 55 to 65 degrees, good oxygen content for the trout lakes that we prefer to fish. That carotid larva may be an olive coloration. And then as the season progresses, the waters get warmer. As water increases, its ability to hold oxygen decreases. That carotid larva, to survive, starts generating hemoglobin, changes its color to red. And then in the fall, when it cools down again, they'll start returning back to their olive coloration. And I've seen them that are a unique barber pole combination of red and green as they transform. So it's bad enough there's enough other colors. Now you got a type of insect that can adjust, not quite like a chameleon, but can change its colors.
Yeah. So when you're talking bloodworm, it's just the coloration of a...
It's actually the slang term that's been given to the whole larval stage. You know, if somebody says, oh, what are you getting them on?
Okay.
Yeah, I'm getting them on bloodworm. That means they're getting them on larval patterns.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, we need to take another break here very quickly. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Phil Moore about fly fishing still waters with chironomids. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 25 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging into their website at www.frontrangeanglers.com. www.frontrangeanglers.com. We're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Phil Raleigh about fly fishing still waters with chironomids. If you'd like to ask Phil a question, just go to our homepage and use that text box to ask a question. We'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, Phil, we're covering a lot of ground, but we got a lot of ground to cover yet, so we got to keep moving here. What about, got a question here about weighted versus non-weighted chironomid patterns. Do you have a preference for either? And if so, how much weight, if any, do you add? He says, I've always been taught that weight on a chironomid is death.
I might, little contrary.
I guess that means you're not going to catch fish.
It depends. I fish chironomid patterns both weighted and unweighted. I would say there's a large cross-section of my patterns in my box are weighted with bead heads, metal beads. I also use glass beads. I tie them unweighted. A lot of it depends on the presentation technique and the depth I'm fishing. If I'm fishing under an indicator, I'm going to use weighted chironomids to help get the fly down. Sometimes even a tungsten bead, although you got to be careful with some of these tungsten beads because they sink so fast that your fly's in the bottom debris before you have a chance to really retrieve it. Again, the weight of the pattern has overpowered your retrieve, much the same way if you use too fast a sinking line. Beads can, in certain situations, what I call pressured waters where fish see an awful lot of anglers and flies, sometimes they can get sensitive to those bright, shiny beadhead patterns. They get to know those sting after a while. And I tie a style of pattern that's very reminiscent of the English epoxy buzzers, and a buzzer is another term for a chironomid. And I call it the Clearwater pupa, and it's a very slender pupa, uses thread for the thorax. It's more of a realistic imitation. And I take 10-thou lead wire or lead wire substitute, if you can find it, or 15-thou, and take a pair of flat-nose pliers and squish it as flat as you can, and then tie that in along the hook prior to forming the fly, and the thread pressure will wrap and envelop that flattened lead around the shank, so you can get away with a weighted fly that's still relatively skinny, because you do need to keep your flies nice and skinny. So weighted flies tend to be, the heavily weighted ones will be under indicators, the not so weighted ones when I'm fishing that naked technique, the dry line long leader. One last thought too, you've also got to consider the wind. Wind will keep those circulation currents, and under a strong windy conditions, just like fishing an unweighted nymph or not a strongly weighted nymph in a river, it'll actually pull the fly up out of the strike zone. It'll stop it from sinking. So sometimes you need a little bit more horsepower in the weight department to get the fly down and fight through that wind-induced circulation currents.
Okay, and a couple questions from Joe in Paradise, California, and also Joe in Lorena, Ohio. Both asking about your favorite patterns, and you had mentioned this about the seasonal aspect of this, but is there, I notice you've got about, what, six or eight different patterns in your book here.
And are that's there, just the tip of the iceberg.
Are there some that stand out for you, the things you'd never be without?
Yeah, as with most fly tires, you're always playing around and experimenting. But if I was to, if I recommend anybody to start anywhere with a chronomid pattern, it's black and red. Black body with a red rib, either red holographic flashaboo I use or red wire. With a black body, and that works very well. A lot of chironomid species are black in color in the pupil stage. My next favorite one is probably the Chromie. Most people know that that fly I had in my first book, Fly Patterns for Still Waters. And this is a very sort of, first glance, is a bit non-traditional because it's a silver flashaboo body with a red rib. And one of the key traits with chironomids, as with other insects, they use trapped air and gases to both help their pupil ascent up through the water column and their final transformation into the winged insect, into the adult phase. This trapped air and gases gives the pupa a distinct silvery shine or glow. And this is a trigger for the trout that are, you know, they see that flash of light off the pupa's body, and then come over and investigate and feed on it. So these silver-bodied ones work very well. Other ones after that, they're probably my two favorite. I've got one called the Collaborator I tie that's kind of got a root beer brown body with a little red butt, and a lot of the chironomid patterns you'll see that I tie and others such as Brian tie have little red butts because when they transform from the larva to the pupa, there's a downsizing that goes on, so the larvae are bigger than the pupa, which in turn are bigger than the adults. It's kind of a downsizing, and this happens with other insects. Mayflies do it too. And you'll get, if you look closely at a chironomid pupa, the very tip of its abdomen is often just fluid and residual hemoglobin, a little red residual hemoglobin from the adult stage, and it also collects sometimes along the abdominal segment, so that's why red ribs are so popular in these flies. I also use one called a green and copper that's green holographic flashaboo for the body, a gold bead, a little peacock behind the bead, white gills, and a gold rib, and that sort of imitates the green stages. Because color, you got to remember, varies with turbidity, available sunlight, depth, lots of factors that come in. What looks one color in our hand is going to look a little different at 12, 15 feet of depth, depending on condition.
A question from Mark in New Zealand. Mm-hmm. How important do you think translucency is in fly design for chironomids? He adds to his question, adding layers of epoxy to patterns. You know, I guess he's asking if that helps.
It does. I use, again, for good chironomid pupa materials and larval materials are generally flashy in nature. So some of my favorites in the Stillwater Solutions line, for example, are the mid-stretch flex, which is a scudback-like material, the mid-stretch floss, which is like a stretch floss material, the mid-braid, which is a woven flashaboo that we unravel to tie in, flashaboos, crystal flashes. I've even used products like angel hair, diamond wing fiber. A lot of the stuff that you associate with saltwater streamer patterns and streamer patterns in general make good because of the reflective qualities that they have. And a lot of times it's not one material, it's the color range within those materials that dictate whether you use them or not. If you're looking for a certain color of olive, it may not be in flashaboo. It may only be in crystal flash, for example. So you've got to be diverse. So you're probably going to go into your local fly shop now, maybe after tonight, and look at that bright, flashy wall with a whole new appreciation for its ability to tie chironomid patterns with it. After I tie all of those, some tires, as Mark's mentioned there, use epoxy. I use a brushable fisherman's glue, it's called. It's a brushable super glue. Comes in a brush applicator. So every one of my chironomid patterns, after I'm finished, I coat the body with this brushable super glue. It gives translucency and it adds durability because flashaboos and a lot of those materials, they're not very bite resistant. So they'll start to unravel and, you know, come to bits after a few fish. This really toughens them up. Rod winding epoxy works very well as well. If you've got time. So I put them on a little. Fisherman's Glue is a brand name out there.
Okay.
I think it's Carlson. Yeah, it's Carlson Industries makes it. The Loctite brand as well also works. Loctite, the stuff, a super glue. And the handy part is it comes with that brush applicator, so you can really control it. And every chironomid pupa and larval pattern I tie primarily nowadays gets a coating of that when it's done.
Okay, Steve in Colorado wants to know, why are ice cream cones, the midge with the white tungsten bead, so effective?
The white bead, I think, is the real key to that fly, and I had the good fortune of talking with the originator, Kelly Davison, when I wrote my first book, and a lot of the lakes that you run across are what we call, often I think Denny Rickards refers to them as nutrient rich, lots of suspended matter, algae, lots of debris, and they can foul a lot of traditional chironomid gill materials, ostrich hurl, yarns, such as midge gill, those kind of things, but the white beads are stark white, and especially the ones we do in the Stillwater line. Brian and I were able to get them, not the pearly white, but a super stark white, so they really stand out, and they really stick out in that sort of turbid water, and fish can really zero in on them, and they don't foul up because they're metal. There's nothing for all that algae to stick to. So I think it's just the simple, that white gill is a real, that's a real trigger for fish, and they'll go over there and investigate that fly and eat it. They're a great pattern. I think one of my first, I talked about fly colors, my favorite, new water, don't know what color chironomid to try yet, going to try something. It's a black or reddish brown midge flex body, red wire rib, and a white, super white bead up at the head. And that fly is performed in BC, Alberta, Washington, Oregon, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, everywhere I've taking it for a swim, trout and char seem to like it.
Now, that begs the question of what you just brought up when you're not sure what the color of the chironomids are in a lake or mm-hmm. the size. How do you find out?
Well, anytime you fly fishing still waters, your most powerful weapon is your eyes. I often joke the only drawback to them is they're attached to your brain, and your brain, being the dominant organ, doesn't like to take information from what it probably deems as lesser organs. But your eyes are your first clue. So when I get to the shore, I'm looking along the shorelines. I'm, inspecting foam lines to see if there's any bugs been trapped in there, spider webs, any insects have been in there, what's flying around. I've got a little aquarium net if I have to catch them. What I see on the water surface, it's amazing with a good pair of polarized glasses and just looking at the world going on around you, how much information is there to be seen. I also use a throat pump, and if I'm fortunate enough to get a fish, I do a sampling of it to see what's inside, and quite often you'll get the most up-to-date information, the live food. Fish swims away if they're used properly without any risk of injury at all. That works well. And then generally, if I still haven't got any clues, it's common to see multiple species and sizes of chironomids coming off, so I tend to start bigger and go smaller, and generally I go from dark to light. So I would start with, the black and red I talked about, then go through my browns, greens, olives, tans, throw the chromie in there from time to time. That chromie really works when when you're really starting to see adults popping and hatching on the surface around you. So you're looking for shucks as well, the residual remains of the pupa that are lying on the water, and you'll see them lying horizontally, and the little tufts, the white gills, stay with the pupal shuck. So you'll start to see those. They look like a little, I guess, a skinny T floating on the water surface. So you're always looking for the clues out there. And it's experimentation. Fish a fly 15, 20 minutes, half an hour max. Nothing happens. Change up. And that's the beauty of if you're in a region where you can fish dropper flies, like in Alberta, we can fish three flies at a time. You can quickly use that and eliminate different sizes and different colors.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Pete in Pennsylvania wants you to dispel the myth that only big flies catch big fish. He says he's convinced by seeing you with pictures of big fish that you've caught on chironomids, but you want to dispel that myth and also talk about, what the size you start out with?
Yeah, generally, I use a lot of the curved scud pupa hooks, like probably my favorite's the Mustad, the C49S. It's a straight eye curved scud pupa hook. It's good strong wire. It gives that natural comma look, and I probably start with a number 10, and because of the short shank, it probably imitates more an actual size 12. So because of the short shank, I get the benefit of a bigger hook, a little heavier iron, the fun of tying on a larger hook, and I'll go from there, 12s, and then I'll start, and 10s rather, 12s, 14s, 16s. We're spoiled a little bit up here in the northern hemisphere, the northern states and the Canadian provinces. I said we've got chironomids that get up to 3/4, 5/8 of an inch. But as your head's further south, you'll generally see a downsizing of insects. So number 10 up in the northern parts, you probably start with a 12 or a 14 and go down to 16s or 18s. But you still get fish on big flies, too. If they're not eating chironomids, they're going to get fed something else. So it could be a big dragonfly nymph, you know, a big number 6, 3 or 4 extra long. It could be a big leech pattern. It could be a baitfish pattern of some kind, a damsel. Again, using my powers of observation, I'm going to try and eliminate the non-productive food sources and focus on the things I'm seeing visible.
Question from David in San Diego. He says, do chironomids size, color, design for fishing tailwaters work in stillwaters?
Absolutely. Zebra midges, disco midges, they'll all work equally well. Again, fish don't get the entomology class. So I've caught fish in lakes with big golden stone nymphs. Somebody's broken them off with a big golden stone nymph in their mouth. And stoneflies are not a stillwater inhabitant. There's not enough oxygenation generally. Some windswept shores you'll find golden stoneflies, but you know that's a trout that saw something that looked like a prey item. Big bug. It was presented properly. I'm going to eat it. They're opportunists for the most part. They're going to eat what they run across. So absolutely, your tailwater patterns, your spring creek patterns, even your river and stream patterns. Hare's ears is a great scud imitation. Prince nymphs work great for when there's water boatmen and back swimmers around. Obviously, a woolly bugger works everywhere. Your river and stream box will transfer nicely to stillwaters.
Well, we don't have time to get into these in any detail at all, but maybe give us kind of a laundry list of flies you'd have in your box for still waters. And I know, you know, you've got quite a few in the recipes book here. So what else would you have in your box?
Well, we'll talk about types. It's probably easier because there's just so many fly patterns out there nowadays. It's a lot of fun. I carry probably a couple well-complemented boxes of chironomids, larva and pupa patterns, which we've talked about. I carry scud patterns, damselfly nymph patterns, dragonfly nymph patterns, leeches. Do a lot of fishing with leech patterns. Well, it's a great searching pattern, cover a lot of water. They're tough to fish in correctly. You can fish them fast, slow, deep, shallow. Water boatmen and back swimmers will have a cross-section of those. They're a little more seasonal generally. They are more available in early spring and late fall. That's when they're most active and most trout seem to key in on them. If there's bait fish present, I will have a cross-section of bait fish patterns as well. Little thunder creeks, small marabou-type patterns, a lot of my own designs to imitate some of the small bait fish that live in lakes. And a box of dries as well. I forgot all about caddis, too. So caddis pupa and larval patterns. Again, hatches take advantage of those. Mayflies, of course, calabatus, very popular Western mayfly species, and an awful lot of fun to fish with very similar methods to the chironomids, nymphs and emergers, and with the dry fly. So you'll have mayfly duns, caddis adults. We fish a lot of buoyant water boatman patterns as well because when they come back to the water, they go on these migration flights and kind of splat into the water and get spin around kind of crazily in the surface film. Trout will key in on them right at the surface, so we'll fish foam-based patterns there. Other dries, you know, chironomids, you know, all the standard fare.
Right, right. Good. Well, that's good cross-section, and I'll tout his book for him, but Phil and Brian's book on Stillwater Recipes, there's some great recipes in there, and it's got a little stand-up book that you can set on your bench and look at while you tie. Real handy the way it was designed, too. So that's the place where you can get just about everything he just talked about from what I can tell. Well, good. Well, we need to take a break. We'll be back in just a few seconds, and then we'll dig into some strategies and presentation. Women's Fly Fishing in Alaska is owned and operated by well-known female guide Hutch Kleinkopf. Women's Fly Fishing offers several lodge-based fly fishing schools for women, as well as an array of small group guided trips for women and couples to some of Alaska's best-known waters for salmon, rainbow trout, arctic grayling, and char. Hutch also leads saltwater fly fishing groups to Mexico each spring. Beginners are welcome and equipment is provided. Learn more about fly fishing for women at www.womensflyfishing.net or call 907-274-7113. That's 907-274-7113. We're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Phil Rowley about fishing still waters with chironomids. If you'd like to ask Phil a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. Okay, Phil, let's talk about strategies. I think, you know, still water can be intimidating to a lot of fly fishers, especially trout fishermen that spend most of their time on streams. So first off, if we're walking up to a new body of water and we're not familiar with still water fishing, where do we find the fish? How do we approach the lake? What do we look for?
Well, I break it down the same way, same sort of three basic principles you do with rivers. Look for areas for comfort, protection, and food. So in the comfort category, you're looking at water temperature, and so a thermometer is a great tool here. So, you know, you're looking for a water temperature governs just about everything that the trout does, how long it eats, when it eats, how much it eats, how long it takes to digest so it'll eat again, how active it's going to be. So I look for that 55 to 65 degree range. So, you know, you can use your thermometer, just a traditional thermometer on a string to locate productive bands of water. They're affected by weather more so than river and stream fish, I found. So, you know, when the barometer starts, I don't know the exact answer why, but the fish do for sure, but that affects them. So when the barometer is up and down like a yo-yo or drops quickly, that tends to put them off the bite, and they'll tend to either just sort of sulk around where they are or actually move into deeper water 15, 20 feet off the edge of drop-offs. Protection comes in the form of algae that blocks sunlight. Most people frown on it when they see it, but it's actually a sign of a productive lake, and it only extends 6 to 10 feet down. It's driven by the sun. The trout cruise around happily underneath. The wind on the surface, the texture, and structure itself, drop-offs, sunken islands, those are places that are going to be fish banks. You ever go into a tropical fish store and look at aquariums and see the rocks and the little weeds, how all the fish relate to those, even if they're not a sit-at-home fish like a bass might be an ambush feeder, but even fish that cruise around, they'll relate to that structure. And, of course, food. That's what we're trying to imitate, and we're trying to take advantage of trout that are feeding. So you're going to concentrate. You know, as fly fishers, we're best suited in water 20 feet deep or less. We get all the presentation tools at our disposal, floating lines, long leaders, variety of sinking lines, all kinds of things like that. And that's where you're going to get your maximum sunlight penetration, which, again, stimulates that weed growth that creates the environment. Also, you can do a lot of it just by standing on the shoreline and making note of the topography of if you look at one end of the lake and that land coming in is very shallow in slope, chances are it's going to be shallow in slope underneath the water. That's going to be a shoal area. Steep-sided shore may have a quick drop-off. Points of land that stick out like fingers. Those are going to be places you want to go. And now you can go on the Internet, and there's all kinds of underwater, bathymetric maps, underwater contour maps. You can do a lot of studying before you ever leave the driveway and look for areas that interesting structure. And then sounders, the electronic technology that's out there nowadays certainly helps as well. They pick out the little nuances along the bottom that an underwater bathymetric map doesn't pick out. I don't believe they find fish. I don't use them for that. It's kind of a field of dreams philosophy, if you will. If you find a structure, the trout will come. So that's kind of the way I go at it.
Question from Tim Bear in Illinois, and also one from Mylan in Atlanta, asking about boats. Are there certain types of craft that you prefer?
I'm either a pontoon boat or a flat-bottom pram. Very popular in Western Canada, United States, the flat-bottom prams, boats. You know, with boats, I remember somebody read somewhere or somebody said, you know, it's all a question of compromise. So they all have their pros and cons. The boats are nice because, you know, you drop something and it's not going to fall in the water and you're going to be out of pocket or anything. But you can get around quickly. Some of the bigger lakes, you know, you may need outboard power or electric power to get around. You're mobile. You can quickly move from one spot to the other. Whereas, you know, with a pontoon boat or a float tube, you've got to kick and paddle, or, you know, with a pontoon boat, you can row your way around. They're nice and stable boats. You can stand up if you want to stretch your legs. I've got a 14-foot flat-bottom pram that I take when I've got more than myself. I've got a 10-foot pram I use, and then I've got a Pac 9000 pontoon boat that I really like as well. And that's got nice portability. It's easy to get around. So it's great, you know, just to throw in the back of the truck or SUV and off you go.
Right.
So I don't think there's one magic craft. It depends. Big lakes, I'm going to use a boat.
Yeah,
a lot of times safety concerns. That wind comes up and you need to get off the water, you can do it. Or I remember when I belly boated a lot, you could get swept down the other end of the lake and have to walk home. And conversely, you just can't get a boat into some of the smaller, intimate ponds and lakes that are out there as well.
Right, they aren't allowed.
So you got to buy them all.
Yeah, I got to buy them all. Okay, I have a question here from John Nishi up in Calgary, Alberta, your neck of the woods up there.
Yeah, I fished with John.
John has a couple of questions. One is, what is your strategy when fishing chronomids in a new lake? What's the quickest way to find the right depth and pattern? And then his second question is, what's the single most important mistake that fly fishers make when fishing chronomids?
Okay, two questions there. Okay, when fishing chronomids, quickest way to find the right depth and pattern? Generally, I'm going to try and get my flies, so I'm fishing them anywhere from 1 to 3 feet off the bottom. You know, trout are going to be just above the weed tops most times, cruising around looking for targets of opportunity. Chronomids, when they transform from the larva into the pupa, they actually suspend in clouds for periods of days before they actually begin their final ascent. And I think that's in part, it takes a while for those trapped air and gases to accumulate, so they're going to hover there. When I did the work for my first book, Fly Patterns for Still Waters, I had 30-gallon aquariums, and I studied them and watched and took pictures of them, and it was really an eye-opening experience to see these pupa hover and stay. And sometimes I would put them into breeding tanks to separate them from the rest of the general population, which would try and eat them. And they'd be in that breeding tank for 3 or 4 days before they emerge. So that's where I'm going to try and be. So, again, I'm going to be looking with my powers of observation, looking for likely structure, shoals. I'm going to be looking for swallows and birds working. Great clue to signs of a hatch, because it's often localized, different areas of the lake, looking for shucks. So once I find an area that looks likely candidate, I'm going to try and choose a technique that's going to allow me to hang that fly 1 to 3 feet off the bottom. Generally 3 feet off the bottom if there's weeds, and if it's a muddy bottom, which is often good chironomid habitat, I'm going to be a little closer to the bottom. And then as for the mistakes people make, the two probably is they don't fish their flies slow enough, and they don't fish them deep enough. So they cast them out, they don't wait for them to sink, and when they start the retrieve, they go too fast. So it's not natural. So first of all, the fly is moving too fast, and the fish perhaps comes suspicious, or if you don't let the fly sink enough, the fish isn't even seeing it. You're just covering the top 3 feet of water, and those fish are 4 or 5 feet down. He'd love to eat it if he could find it.
So deep and slow.
Deep and slow.
And then work your way up, I take it, in the water column?
Yeah, generally you start, you'll start down. I always start down near the bottom and work my way up. You know, there's some factors that are going to bring, if it's bright light, I'm going to fish a little deeper water or a little closer to the bottom. Fish, you know, I find they like to feed in low light conditions or, you know, over cloudy days or, you know, the sun's broke up. But a flat, calm, sunny, bright day is probably the toughest still water conditions you'll come across, especially when you couple that with clear water. It's just very, very hard to present the fly in such a manner that the fish don't know you're there. Yeah, so deep and slow.
Kind of talked about these two. We've answered a couple questions from Don in Ohio and Brian about the go-to chronomid and so forth, so we'll skip over those. Please tell us again, and this is unknown from Colorado, please tell us again about how painfully slow the retrieve can be for deep water chronomids.
It can be slow. That's
what
a great
question. What is slow?
Slow is, I'm just trying to visualize in my mind, you're going to gather a foot of line in 10 or 15 seconds. So it's slow, and I'm using a slow, my favorite retrieve is a hand twist retrieve. Very, very slowly, because it's a busy retrieve. Humans were impatient. The hand twist, you're getting lots of hand movement, but the fly's not moving that much. Strip retrieves, if you strip, you run the risk of stripping the fly too fast. So very, very slow. Just when you think you've got it right, cut it in half again is a general rule. Most veteran fishermen that I learned from told me, just slow is slow. You're probably, from cast to recast, you may be 15 minutes if you don't get a take, but usually you get a grab somewhere in there, so it's a lot shorter.
So basically what you're trying to do is cover the water and make it like the fly, the chronomid, is not moving.
Well, yeah, because the because the chronomids are elevated.
They still float, but you're trying to cover water with them.
Well, you're trying to strike a balance. When you're using without an indicator, you're striking a balance between leader length, that's that 25% formula so the fly can get down there, speed of the retrieve. So when you're fishing a floating line, if you go too fast, that fly will follow up through the water column. And what you're trying to do, although chironomids do move vertically in the column. Typically, fish will focus on them at a certain depth, and you're trying to keep your fly in that depth for as long as you can. So that slow retrieve speed keeps the fly down there. You've got your pattern weight to consider. So it can get down there, but it's not too fast, not too slow. It's a bit of a Goldilocks thing going on here. And then wait time, literally that time you let it sink. So typically I'm going to cast a fly out if I'm working. I remember fishing a lake in southwestern Manitoba, some fantastic stillwater fisheries there, using about 17, 18 feet a leader without an indicator. I cast it out. Wait 30 seconds. I actually use my watch to help guide. So if you've got other fishers in the boat and no distractions, you can just look at your watch and then start that slow hand twist retrieve. So again, you got to let it get down there. So the slow hand twist is the way to go. Generally, a good rule is if you want to bring that fly back, you just want to maintain tension in the floating line. And if you look at the rod tip, you don't want that fly line to skip up. You know, when you use a faster retrieve, the fly line will sort of jump a little bit off the water. You just want them almost like you're dragging it over the surface of the water. It's slow.
Okay, is there any other retrieves that you use, or is that the only retrieve?
You can use, sometimes I will use what I call a pinch strip retrieve. And what I'm doing is I've got, as soon as I make the cast, in any stillwater situation, you make the cast, it's a straight line cast, no slack. As soon as that fly line lands, rod tip right down to the water surface, or in the case of sinking lines, I actually stab it right into the surface. You want to have that direct connection. You got to remember, in a stillwater environment, fish can come up, sample that fly, and spit it out in a heartbeat. And if you have any kind of slack in the system, they'll exploit it. You'll never feel it. So it's tight to the fly. And sometimes when you cast a sinking line, good trick is a couple of quick strips to make sure there's no slack in the system, because sometimes that fly is fluttering down, fish will grab it on the sink. And if you've got any slack, he grabs and spits and you miss him. So let that fly sink. So I got that rod tip straight down. I take the fly line. I pinch it between the thumb and forefinger of my casting hand that's holding the rod. And then I put my retrieve hand, if you will. I'll take the four fingers and put them against the back of my hand and hold them there, and then use my thumb and forefinger to pinch from behind my rod hand. And by simply keeping the two hands together, I can't go any faster. If my hands are apart, I can run the risk of stripping too fast, but if I keep them joined, again, by touching the fingers of my retrieve hand against the back or the side of my hamster. If my hands are apart, I can run the risk of stripping too fast, but if I keep them joined, again, by touching the fingers of my retrieve hand against the back or the side of my hand of my rod hand, and just use a thumb and finger pinching motion to pinch the fly line back in short half to three-quarters.
You're moving like an inch or something every time.
Three-quarters of an inch sometimes. I'm just pinching it in, and because the hands are connected, I can't go faster. You know, the thumb and forefinger only go so fast. So those are the two for chironomids. And, you know, for general stillwater retrieves, you can pick up the pace on either the strip or the hand twist. And again, once you study the insects and learn how they move and behave in the water column, you're going to choose a retrieve pattern to make your fly behave like that food source.
You kind of alluded to a point that I hadn't thought about but makes total sense is, you know, when you're fishing streams, your fly is almost always moving.
Mm-hmm.
So if a fish takes it, you've got the movement of the river moving the fly and the fish moving, and you've got a much better chance of feeling it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in a lake, it's just floating. It's like a spaceman out there, right?
if you've got any slack in the system, they can grab it. You have to be tight to the fly. You have to be able to react in a moment to anything that's from, you know, a arm-jarring strike to just seeing that tip of the fly line dart left or right or just pull under slightly.
Okay. Sounds good. Let's see here. We've got one here that was kind of interesting. Bob in Southern California. I do quite well on the 4 to 6 pound trout at Sugar Creek Ranch out here in Northern California, but I have trouble getting the larger 10 or 12 pounders. Poor guy, huh?
Those 4 to 6 pounders don't sound bad.
I know, that's what I'm saying.
I'm gonna have to go down. I gotta get down more to California. It sounds.
Yeah. So poor Bob can't get the 10 to 12 pounders to take his offerings. Sorry, Bob. We're just not feeling sorry for you. But what does he do to get the bigger fish? I mean,
well,
we all want that bigger fish.
Yeah,
so.
And big fish are a challenge because there's some things that go on generally we catch lots of the smaller fish. Fish like to hang around in the same age class. And when they get together in a group, you know, that's why when they freshly stock a lake, it's you know, people, it could almost be unfair because they're so, A, inexperienced in the wilds, and B, they're so competitive with each other, they will just go chase. It's almost like they see another fish going for something, they just chase for it because they don't want the other fish to get it. As fish grow and mature and natural selection takes over, these big fish become very solitary in their habits, and they're a lot harder to dupe. You don't have that competition thing going on, so they're really suspicious. You know, they didn't get big by being foolish, right? So they're a little harder to dupe. A lot of times, believe it or not, you end up, one of my methods is I use smaller patterns, small scuds, small chironomids, move them very, very slowly. Natural colors too. I try to stay away from the more garish, sometimes even a couple of strands of flashaboo in the fly can put the fish off. So a lot more somber, natural colors, you know, light olives, tans, browns, olives in general. Just a really imitative approach and just really a good presentation as far as choosing the right depth and moving the fly. You know, as we talked about a few seconds ago, it's all, kind of all in the hands. Those big fish, they're a challenge, and that's what makes them so special. They're not easy to get. There's no magic switch. And they tend to feed... You know, their feeding cycles, they'll feed at low light conditions, so sometimes you've got to get on the water really bright and early to get at them. They'll be in the shallows, they'll do their foraging, and then they'll move off to digest or move out into deeper reaches and let those small 5 or 6 pound fish, come in and feed. So they're a good challenge.
If you're catching...
I have to tell Bob, I'll have to go down there.
yeah, we have to hook up with him. When you were just saying, you know, the larger fish tend to be more solitary, and so if you're catching a lot of small fish, and I don't mean 4 to 6 pounders, but I mean, you know, you're catching 12 to 14 inch fish or something like that, then are you saying move to a different spot?
Yeah, a lot of times that's the general rule. If you're catching a lot of the small fish, the bigger fish won't be there. You need to go find a couple, it's a sign of a good healthy ecosystem. You've got, you know, lots of differing fish sizes, so the lake's in a good healthy state. Fish are growing and maturing. So you may have to move and go find different areas. You know, generally those smaller fish like to inhabit the shallow areas. You know, they get preyed upon, so they'll hide in amongst the weeds. And sometimes the bigger fish will be out more off the edges of the drop-offs, sunken islands, in the deeper parts, maybe over 6, 8, 10, 12 feet over the weeds. You've got to move around to find them. You're always moving. Don't sit and anchor yourself in one spot and repeatedly cover. In fact, a lot of times, one of the techniques I use sometimes is to use, and the Europeans, particularly the English, do it as well, is the drogues, the underwater parachutes, the drift socks, if you will. And they're boats, they're fishing flies, they're not trolling. They're using this parachute to retard the drifting motion and control the motion of the boat. And they are still presenting the flies, but they're always presenting their flies to new fish.
Yeah, always moving. Great.
Yeah, always moving, covering water.
That's a good note to end on because we're out of time, and time flies by, but we covered a lot, I think, Phil, and I'm sure everybody learned quite a bit tonight, so that's always our goal. But unfortunately, we got to wrap things up here, but hang tight, everybody. We've got a few more things happening. In fact, we're going to give away that 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and the 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine, where you can read Phil's column. And also, we're giving away Phil's latest book and DVD, so stay tuned to see if you win. Family Ties, and that's T-Y-E-S, Family Ties is an organization which uses a shared interest in fly fishing and fly tying to enhance youth development and family relationships. They utilize resources in schools, communities, and businesses, and they invite your participation. Go to their website, www.familytiesties.com. Family Ties, where every fish is a trophy and every kid is a hero. Well, just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under Phil's section there that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away the prizes. The first two are random drawings from our database, and you'll need to have filled out the registration form prior to this. If you haven't by now, it's too late, but make sure you do it for the next show because we're always giving away great prizes. So the first thing we're going to give away is a membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, 3-year membership. And if you want to learn more about the Federation, go to www.fedflyfishers.org, www.fedflyfishers.org. It's an international, both saltwater and freshwater organization. So we'll press the button here and see what it pulls out of the database. And we've got Rick Lang in Alberta, up in your neck of the woods there again, Bill. So, Rick, he's in Alberta, Canada. Congratulations on that 3-year membership. He will email you and ask you for your information so we can get you that membership started. Now we'll give away the Fly Fusion magazine, 1-year subscription to that. And Fly Fusion magazine, if you want to learn more about them, they're at www.flyfusionmag.com. Wonderful magazine, great photography, great articles on how to do things. And that's kind of their forte, so check them out. And our winner for that is Treg Owens in Idaho. Treg Owens, and Treg had asked a question tonight, so that was nice that he was rewarded here with a subscription to Fly Fusion. Great. Well, congratulations, Treg. Well, now, okay, I hope you guys are ready. We're going to do our live drawing. Okay, first person to answer the question correctly will get Phil and Brian's book, Stillwater Solution Recipes. It's got all the patterns, 30 proven patterns, that many of which we talked about tonight, and a lot of the chronomid patterns are in here. So that will be first prize. The second prize we're going to give away is a DVD on fly tying. Phil, what's the title of that?
It's called Tying and Fishing Stillwater Flies with me.
with you, okay.
With me, yes.
Oh, that's part of the title, okay.
Yes, with me, really.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so here we go, guys. Now what you got to do is fill this out on the home page there in the text box. Then the first person to answer this question, and you have to put in your name and your location, too, to get this right. Okay, so I hope I asked this question properly, but Bill had mentioned there was one pattern that he goes to most regularly, and I'm not going to ask you the pattern name, but what is the color of the body and the color of the rib that was his go-to fly? The color of the body and the color of the rib. First person gets Phil's book, and see if we've got anybody that was listening closely here, Phil. There is a correct answer to that question, isn't there, Phil?
Oh, yes. And that fly, one of the variations of that fly actually has a name, but you're right, I didn't say it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, first person that answers is Sean in Foxborough, Massachusetts. He says black and red.
That's right.
Say, Phil.
That's correct. Yeah, I tie one with a black body and a red holographic rib, and I call it the Black Sally. So.
Okay, next person answered olive. That's not it. Next person, Mark Power in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Black body, red rib. So I think we got our two winners. Don't you
Excellent.
Think, Phil?
Yep.
Good. Okay, so Sean and Mark, congratulations. Send me either via the way you just answered through the text box, send me your email address so that I can get a hold of you to get your other information. And if that doesn't work for you for some reason, you can also send it or as a backup send it to by email to info@askaboutflyfishing.com. And then we'll get your details and we can get these prizes out to you. Well, Phil, thanks a lot for offering those prizes. That's great. And thank you so much for being on the show tonight. I learned a whole lot, and I'm ready to go out there and hit the lake now. And maybe I'll do some good this time. Yeah, I really appreciate you being on the show and taking the time out of your busy schedule to do this for us.
Oh, you're very welcome, Roger. I really enjoyed it. And if anybody has other questions, they can go to my website, Flycraft Angling again, and email me directly if there's something that wasn't clear or they've got a question that popped into their mind. I'd be happy to take the time and answer it for them.
Well, that's very nice of you to do that and offer that. So, guys, take advantage of it. Check out Phil's site, and I'm sure you'll enjoy it. You'll learn even more. Well, our next broadcast will be on September 3rd, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern time, and on that show we'll be interviewing Tim Heng, and our topic for the show will be fly fishing the Frying Pan River here in Colorado. It's a first-class fishery, and Tim has fished just about every inch of the Frying Pan River and has been doing so for the past 30 years. So you'll learn a lot about the Frying Pan and some of its well-kept secrets for hooking up for the big trout that are in it. We'd like to thank Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Fast Time Charters, Front Range Anglers, Housatonic River Outfitters, and Women's Fly Fishing in Alaska for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-888-961-1115, extension 2, and we'll be happy to explain the options to you. Don't forget to visit our website, askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.